This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Tomorrow, we'll say goodbye to the marvelous Mrs. Maisel as the lauded comedy releases its final episode after a five-year award-laden run. When it comes to the New Yorkiest of New Yorkie shows, the marvelous Mrs. Maisel is a bit of a time capsule comedy.
Hi, Grandpa.
Your mother thinks we're schnorrers.
Hi, Grandma.
Your grandfather's being stubborn.
Hi, Mommy.
Go back to bed, Ethan.
The series starts in the late 1950s when Midge Maisel, a well-bred Upper West Side Jewish stay-at-home mother of two, discovers her husband is having an affair with his receptionist. Midge heads downtown, gasp, and tells her story on stage at a village comedy club.
So my life completely fell apart today. Did I mention that my husband left me?
There she discovers her own voice and decides to pursue a career as a profane and outspoken female comic. When The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel debuted in 2017, it helped put Amazon Prime on the map as a streaming service. It was created by the powerhouse team of Amy Sherman Palladino and Dan Palladino, the duo behind The Gilmore Girls and Bunheads. The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel was a roaring success, raking in Emmys, Golden Globes, and even a Peabody Award. We had the pleasure of having Amy and Dan Palladino join us in the studio, and in honor of the show's finale, here's an encore presentation of that interview from 2019. I began the conversation by asking Amy Sherman Palladino to describe Midge Maisel's character arc.
I wanted her to be someone who's like, this is it. I won. This is great. So when it left her, she really felt like she had completely lost everything. And then she sort of found her superpower, which is comedy and being able to get up on stage and talk about her life and talk about everyone else in her life, whether they want her to or not. And she also discovered a really strong, ambitious streak in her that has sort of taken over everything, is sort of her new guiding light. So, and she wears really cute dresses.
She wears
like
great.
Such cute dresses.
Great.
So really tiny waist, and she wears hats, and it's adorable. And
Rachel Brosnahan was pretty unknown to most people, not a household name when she took the role. What is it about her, you think, that she gets about this part?
When she first, it's unusual. A lot of people in our business, in the comedy business, are kind of like, if it's someone playing a stand-up comic, it should either be a stand-up comic or obviously someone who's done comedy. And Rachel had done, I think, almost pretty much no comedy.
Yeah, I think Rachel's entire career was her being kidnapped and thrown in ditches and a lot of crying.
Yeah, and to Amazon's credit, a lot of companies would ding an actress like this and just say, we don't want to experiment with somebody trying to act funny. But to us, we were really intrigued. And I think what she came in was, again, it's the confidence word. Midge is very confident. Rachel is very confident. So that really helps. Like she was holding her sides and her hands were not shaking. And a lot of actresses' hands shake. It was a big part to audition for, and we gave them three big scenes to do. So I think the confidence, and I think the sort of, she also kind of got the underlying anger that is in every comedian. And she sort of innately got that, and she's just this incredible actress who pulled off the stunt of being a realistic stand-up comic, going through all the phases of learning it. It was a really tough thing to do, and I think just the confidence is what really sold it.
And to Midge's confidence, that confidence doesn't always make her 100% likable.
Mm-hmm.
No, and we weren't actually interested in that, because we had come from, you spend years on network television where they're like, she can't raise her voice, that's not likable. Or, make sure she doesn't wear red. Red is not likable. And like, the hair, make sure the hair is really likable. So like the last thing in the world I ever want to hear again in my entire life is the female character likable? It's just, is she interesting? Is she viable? Is her journey something that people want to watch? And the great thing about, again, Rachel Brosnahan, who is kind of just a steamroller through life, she wasn't interested in being likable. She was interested in playing somebody very interesting and very different from what she had played before. And we got lucky that, because you don't want to have to spend half your time talking your actress into, it doesn't matter if you're likable. Mm-hmm. It's okay if you raise your voice. It doesn't matter. You're a human being. Sometimes human beings aren't likable.
90% of them are never likable. You know, at least you're going to be likable like 50, 60% of the time. That's not bad by human standards. So
yeah, and men have been pulling it off in TV for many, many years. Al from Deadwood, everyone loved him. Tony Soprano, everyone loved him. Walter White, everyone loved him. If you hated those guys personally, you would not watch the show, even though they were often despicable. There's been an obvious double standard for women characters in movies and TV, and so we wanted to make sure that you saw the foibles of this character too, that you saw that she was human and sometimes very, very selfish and sometimes very, very self-centered and maybe not the best mother all the time, as, you know, mothering standards were so different back then. We wanted to reflect that you didn't hover over your child and you didn't necessarily tell your child you loved them every day and every hour. So we're trying to do what men have gotten away with for a long time.
Ambition in women is something that I think a lot of times people think is an unattractive trait. And yet in men, ambition is how you get what you want in life. And the more that Midge performs and the more that she hones her skills, the more she realizes how ambitious she is, that she doesn't just want to get up at the Gaslight and have her Wednesday night set. She wants to be famous. She wants to take this as far as she can take it. And that's her learning that is both a little unnerving to herself, to everyone around her. And yet, like, that is sort of the driving force now. It is like that fierce ambition is going to be pulling against her natural need to, like, do I want family and comfort and the, you know, go to the butcher shop and look cute every day and hang out with my mom in the same apartment that I grew up in? Or do I want to take over the world, which could be a lonelier, scarier, maybe less emotionally fulfilling and yet more fulfilling in some ways. So, like, that's going to be her pull for the rest of the series.
You said something so interesting in your answer about actresses being concerned about their perception of not being likable, even though they're playing a part. Is that really an issue for young actresses that you've run into?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, part of what's interesting that I found, because I tend to write characters who at some point are going to yell. Just at some point, usually in the pilot, they're going to yell at somebody. And I have found that it's a hard thing for a lot of actresses to do because they are so aware of the fact that behind the scenes, a lot of times they are judged on how feminine you are and how likable you are, and raising your voice and yelling is not considered a likable trait in a woman. And a lot of times you have to really tell actresses, like, you gotta yell.
Yeah, it's okay.
You're pissed. Mm-hmm. You gotta yell. Mm-hmm. Your husband left you. If there's any time when you can yell, perhaps this is the time. So it is a thing, and hopefully the more that parts are being written for actresses that aren't being decided on the level of likability, but more on the level, like, what is the journey? How interesting is this person? Do they have a story to tell? Maybe actresses in the future will not be coming to the table with that sort of baggage on them. But it is an issue, and not for Rachel.
Rachel's good.
Rachel doesn't care. Rachel's like, I'll just go out there, and you want me to kill a kitten? I'll do it. That's fine. I'm good.
My guests are Amy Sherman-Palladino and Dan Palladino. One of the things I think I interesting about the show, there are many interesting things, but I like the sort of anthropological sort of excavation of New York City and this particular family at this time. There are a lot of details about this affluent Jewish family on the Upper West Side, down to, like, where the dad works and how they keep the house. What was it about this time period that you thought was really ripe? And if you could share a couple of details that you put in the script and in the family composition to let us know more about this family at this time.
Well, the time period was really picked because comedy was starting to shift a little bit and starting to become a little bit more talking about real things and life and politics and family and sexuality and it hadn't been before. Comedy had been a little bit more like, take my wife, please, mm-hmm. you know. So we felt like that time period would be an interesting time to throw someone who's just starting a career in comedy, because it's straddling that old school, new school world, and especially a woman, where there just weren't a lot of women in comedy. There are. It's tough for a woman in comedy now, but back then it was a nightmare. And to put somebody who is finding her voice, so actually talking about things is going to be important to her, and not pretending to be a character or a, you know, quaint or ugly, you know, not putting a weird boa on her, you know, and talk about a voice, you know, like that she's actually going to go and talk about being young, being possibly divorced, possibly what does she do now, children, should she have been a mother, she never thought about it before, that these are things that she wants to be able to talk about on stage. That time period felt right for that.
Yeah, and as far as the family and the whole setting, you know, we always kept in mind that, like, this is a generation and a time when World War II, like, almost all the young men walking around were World War II veterans. When Zach Levi came on last year and played the Dr. Benjamin, I don't know if we mentioned it, but we told him he is a World War II veteran. So we always kept that in mind. And of course, for a Jewish family, we always keep in mind that the Holocaust was 15 years before. And that also, not only was it the heartbreak of that era and of what happened, but also this is a Jewish family now that is prosperous, feeling safe, feeling affluent, and is really becoming a natural part of the American fabric. So that's something that we always kind of keep in mind too. And of course, Midge kind of blows it up with because of what happened to her, she decides to take a path that this family was not expecting, that this family did not want. So everything's kind of shaken up, but it is a family that was just sort of becoming like the true American family back then.
There's a lot of references to real. Lenny Bruce shows up, real people. And there's a Jane Jacobs rally.
And she's on camera.
Sure, why not?
Why not?
I mean, Jane Jacobs has not gotten her due. So.
Because, you know, the younger demographic was dying for an on-screen depiction
of
Jane Jacobs.
If I could tell you how many letters
Jane Jacobs.
We got.
14-year-olds, 15-year-olds, there's such Jane Jacobs fanatics. It's crazy.
When you sit down and you work together and you decide to write and incorporate something like that, how does that come up? Is it just, hey, Dan, I got an idea, let's put in Jane Jacobs, or is it more planned than that?
Well, we discovered at the time that Jane Jacobs did have this really big rally because they were going to build a road through Washington Square Park. A lot of people don't remember that, but it was going to go, I think, through
the arch.
The arch, and the traffic was going to go right through it. And this was the stuff, this was the Robert Moses era, and this was the stuff that a lot that people had not been fighting, and the fight was starting, and Jane Jacobs was starting to lead that fight, mm-hmm. and she did lead that fight. So even the signage, so we recreated that in season one, and even the signage they had was the exact signage that they had, the exact
cool.
words on the signs that they had back then. So Jane Jacobs came out of, like, it was we knew it was happening, and we knew it would be a funny thing for Midge to stumble upon. So sometimes it's just a matter of, like, it wasn't really this burning desire to have Jane Jacobs on, but it just was the right format for Midge to have some comedy and in fact, go up and do an impromptu sort of comedy routine, which she did in that episode.
Everything's got to come out of story. And like, we didn't want to set out to do just a show of people showing up and doing impressions. You know, that's not really what the show is, because we're building our own reality here. But at certain times, there are certain touchstones. You know, Lenny Bruce came about because he is sort of the example of the new comedy and the new way of thinking. And it felt like he would be a good muse for her and a good, somebody to emulate up to a certain point where, you know, it sort of went wrong for him, which we haven't hit yet. But at this point, when he was really somebody talking about things, it felt like that's a good touchstone for her. And so we threw him in the pilot sort of as that representation. And then, of course, we fell in love with Lou Kirby, and he's such a great actor, and it just felt like it popped up a lot more, like times to bring him back. But, you know, just as much we make up, you know, the Jane Lynch character who plays Sophie Lennon, she's not a real character. She's sort of, we took bits and pieces of other, you know, ideas of other female comics and sort of
Sophie Tucker, the reclamation of that name.
A little bit. You know, Phyllis Diller would go home and paint. You know, it's like, and she'd be very,
and lived in Bel Air.
Yeah, live in Bel Air. You know, Joan Rivers had these beautiful antiques that she cared about, you know, and really wanted to be a serious actress. So it's like we took sort of bits and pieces of these other comedians and sort of put them together in Jane Lynch. So it, when it, basically, it's all about us. When it suits us, we'll do it. And when it doesn't suit us, you know, screw it.
My guests are Amy Sherman Palladino and Dan Palladino. I heard you say it earlier when I was watching a roundtable interview that you were on of writers, just your joy of not being at a network.
Oh, my God.
Let's put it in the positive, shall we?
Hallelujah.
So for civilians.
Yes.
Let's say you were doing this show for a major network. Think about a scene or something that you wanted to do that, and how that would have gone at the network.
Well, this show could not have been done at the network.
Period.
No, they would never have, in a gazillion years, they all would have said, oh my God, we want to do that show. And that would be the end of it. They may have even gone so far as to pick up a pilot. And then you try to cast it, and that would have been the end of it. I mean, it's.
And then they would damn you, like, if when they call you to tell you that your project's not going forward, the first thing they say to people like us is, "I love the writing. I love the writing is so amazing." And Amy and I look at each other like,
"Oh, we're
we
dead.
Are sunk.
we've just dead. Been canceled. It's all over."
You know, we're still schmucks with Underwoods, but. It's really like there's a lot of reasons why this character went, you know, because you see this character and you think, oh, she's so sweet, she's so likable, and she's her journey is interesting to me. But they would not like a lot of aspects of it. They would not like her ambition. And I'm saying traditionally, you know, the networks. I don't know who's at the networks now because we haven't worked at a network in ages.
And we never will again.
But we came up in a system where basically. We're not going to tell you exactly how old we are.
130,000.
We're the same vintage.
It's something like that. Yeah, but we came up at a time when basically there were like four networks, and it was an extremely conservative business. And we're not just talking about now we can say curse words on TV, which has positives, but you don't have to. All in the Family was a great show. It was on a network. They never said a curse word. They said certain words that we don't say anymore. But there have been great network comedies, great network shows, but generally
not in a long time though.
Because, not in a long time.
The thing about the networks that people need to understand is networks are run by the marketing department. And that is the basic difference. When the marketing department, the people who have to sell soap, are making creative decisions, and that is the bottom line, then you're screwed. Because they only care about the demographics that's going to buy the Tide or buy the car or buy this. And your piece has to conform to that. There is no interest in conforming what they do to your piece. Also, they have changed the structure of television so much. When, you know, back in the old days, you know, when Dan and I and the dinosaurs roamed the earth and we first started out in sitcom was two acts. It's what, five, six acts now?
Yeah, I mean.
So they keep chopping it up, and they make the actual playing time shorter to put more commercial time in. So your ability to tell any sort of cohesive story goes right out the window, because every time you got an act break that you got to go to commercial, you want to try and keep them and bring them back. So you can't just take a story and then chop it up. There's got to be a dun-dun-dun moment.
Yeah. Bam,
and then,
bam, bam.
And then half the time, right, when you come back from the commercial, you have to take back the dun-dun-dun moment because it was a lie, because you had to put it in and then you had to sell the soap and then you got to continue on. And it's exhausting. And it's just not a creative way of thinking about storytelling or character or the process. It's not gratifying to have to have nobody in the sphere of power be interested in the actual creative aspect of it, because that's really not what network television is set up to do. They are set up to sell ad time. And when you go to a streaming service, they don't care. Okay, you know, Kellogg's is like anyone else. Kellogg's can figure out how to turn on the, you know, and fast forward, and you know, they're just watchers. They have no skin in the game.
Well, I would think they would care more about the quality of the content because they have to entice people to come to it.
It's sort
of
like so the public radio to
model.
Go.
Yeah. The public media model. It's the quality.
Yes.
Or even the HBO, you know, it's the quality of the content that
it's
makes people
it's
you
HBO.
Have to take a jump.
Yeah.
Right, like A Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is not going to have as many viewers as like Hawaii Five-O at its peak on the network. But I have a feeling they don't share any data with us, and we don't need to know the data. But I have a feeling that like a show like Marvelous Mrs. Maisel probably draws us a certain enough people of a like interest that suit them in some way. And they let us do our thing. And it's really nice to be able to do our thing. And then it's up to us to entertain the audience. Like, if people like Amazon let us do our thing, then the responsibility is on us to do our thing well, because the audience is always right.
That was my conversation with Amy Sherman Palladino and Dan Palladino, the executive producers of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Its final episode starts streaming on Amazon Prime tomorrow. That's Friday. There's more All of It on the way, including your remembrances of Tina Turner. Text them to us. The text is number is 212-433-9692. 212-433-WNYC. Help us remember Tina Turner. That's happening right after the news.